Hey folks, this is your volunteer reader, Mike Malangoni. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is the Monday, February 10th edition of Business World. Thanks for joining us again this week. Don't forget, if you miss any portion of this program or any other of your favorite programs or any programs that you may never have heard before because they only exist there, please do check out sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. There you can find all kinds of on-demand programming, listenable at your convenience, at your leisure. This week, we're going to be looking at, you guessed it, Bloomberg Businessweek articles. We'll start up with a quickie from Joshua Green, one of our favorite feature writers who doesn't really write features anymore. He's busy writing books. One thing's for sure about Iowa, New Hampshire is next. Instead of clarifying anything for the Democratic nomination, it did the opposite. I wanted to check in with what's going on in politics there. Followed up by Drake Bennett's massive feature piece, The Time I Sabotaged My Editor with Ransomware from the Dark Web. And after that, we're going to look at the other feature article. This one with Janet Lauren is by our good friend Sabrina Wilmer. A sexist joke cost Ken Fisher $4 billion in assets. He still runs $121 billion. Some big investors were quick to drop the money manager, but his sales machine is doing just fine. So, that's our agenda for today. Please do sit back, relax, and enjoy the next 56 or so minutes of Business World. As mentioned, that first article from Joshua Green, one thing's for sure about Iowa, New Hampshire is next. The Iowa caucuses usually play a critical role in the presidential primary process by testing the candidates, winnowing the field, and slingshotting the top two or three finishers to national prominence. The results coming out of Iowa often shape the national narrative for the rest of the race. But this year's app-induced fiasco, which produced a low-confidence split decision between Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders, won't even fulfill that basic function. The only certainty coming out of Iowa was that all of the candidates are now going on to New Hampshire. Instead of clarifying questions of viability and moving the party forward and settling on a nominee, it did the opposite. Absent a clean result, candidates like Joe Biden and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who placed well below the first tier, escaped the reckoning that ordinarily accompanies disappointing finishes. A decisive Buttigieg or Sanders victory typically would have produced a fundraising windfall, glowing media coverage, and a strong bounce in the polls. Since 1976, the Iowa winner has gained an average of more than 12 points in national polls in the month following the caucuses. With no one getting that boost, no one will be forced from the race. For the party's left wing, the results were a frustrating muddle. The tepid third-place finish of Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren ratified the belief that she's fallen back from last fall's front-runner status and isn't broadening her coalition into a unifying movement that could go all the way. And while Sanders remains a viable threat to win the nomination, he didn't demonstrate anything like the runaway strength his backers hoped for and his opponents feared. After spending $50 million in the last 3 months of the year, it looks as though the Vermont senator will end up drawing about half the level of support in Iowa that he did 4 years ago. That means a lot of his 2016 followers switched their allegiance, hardly the stuff of revolution. Moderate and centrist voters may have it even worse. While Biden's strength in national polls has been the one constant throughout the past year, his poor caucus showing, scattershot organizing, and lackluster fundraising bring new doubts about whether voters will ultimately decide that the 77-year-old former vice president has the stamina to face off against Trump. The map will soon improve for Biden when southern states start voting, but he'll have to stave off an exodus of support before then. Sanders rose to the top of Iowa and New Hampshire polls because he faced nothing like the attacks on his policies that Biden and Warren and Buttigieg have endured and suffered from. Now, amid the cloud of confusion and recriminations from the Iowa results, some Democrats say he may escape that fate until it's too late for centrists to stop him. Warren spent 2 months undergoing rigorous scrutiny for supporting Bernie's Medicare for All policy, scrutiny that was never applied to him, says Brian Fallon, a former top Hillary Clinton aide who's neutral in the race. It's a symptom of the failure of D.C. Democrats to take his chances of winning the nomination seriously enough. Sanders' fundraising strength and passionate base of supporters make him a serious contender, even if it takes a little longer to secure the nomination. That's left establishment Democrats struggling to embrace the possibility of a socialist standard bearer. Bernie would have a hard time winning the election, says former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, a Biden supporter. But if he wins the nomination, I'd do the best I could for him. I'd be all in for Bernie. It's a wild thought. Could Buttigieg parlay his Iowa showing to rival Sanders in upcoming contests? Perhaps. In the weeks leading up to Monday night's first-in-the-nation Democratic contest, Sanders had seemed to be pulling away from the field. Buttigieg appeared to be sinking, especially after Warren branded him a privileged enabler of tech and finance titans who showered him with money in a lavish wine cave fundraiser. Yet the 38-year-old former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, relied on his moderate appeal and dedicated turnout operation to overperform in rural and suburban areas across the state. Betting that fortune favors the bold, Buttigieg also relied on moxie, marching out amid the caucus night chaos to declare a victory that was far from certain, infuriating the Sanders campaign and other top finishers. "We don't know all the results," he declared to the crowd, auto-tuning his rhetoric to match the soaring cadence of former President Barack Obama, "but we know, by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation, because by all indications, we are going on to New Hampshire victorious." Buttigieg's stubborn unpopularity among the black voters, who will be critical in deciding South Carolina and Super Tuesday states, poses what still could be an insurmountable hurdle. And thanks to the delayed caucus results, Buttigieg, for whom developing a national campaign infrastructure was already challenging, can't expect to benefit from the sudden influx of money and support usually directed at the Iowa winner. This could open the door for someone who already has a national campaign team, virtual control of the TV airwaves, and almost unlimited resources. Michael Bloomberg. A late entrant to the field who didn't compete in Iowa, the former New York City mayor has a message of competent managerial centrism and a willingness to spend $1 billion to defeat Trump, which could be newly attractive to Democrats spooked by the debacle they just witnessed. Disclosure here, Bloomberg is the founder and majority owner of Bloomberg LP, the parent company of Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg News. His viability at this point is still theoretical. To be the Sanders slayer and centrist alternative to Biden and Buttigieg, he'll first need to persuade primary voters to pull the lever for him. At the first sign that voters are willing, he'll also have to contend with a populist backlash from energized partisans on the left wing. Besides the failure to clarify much of anything, the Iowa caucuses amplified a set of issues that Democratic officials are quietly worried about. A full year of campaigning has done nothing to settle the central debate within the party between those who believe a nominee must steer leftward to excite and attract new voters, and those who believe that such a course would guarantee President Trump another term. Iowa's neck-and-neck finish between Buttigieg and the moderate and Sanders the radical is the party's conundrum come to life. Then there's the matter of excitement, or lack of it. On a day when Gallup measured Trump's approval rating at an all-time high of 49%, Iowa Democrats showed up to caucus in only modest numbers. Not long ago, state party officials expected turnout to rival or exceed the record level of 240,000 set during Obama's first run in 2008. Instead, it was closer to 2016's level of 170,000. Democrats are counting on a growing blue wave of enthusiasm to oust Trump. Iowa denied them that, too. And that, from Joshua Green, was one thing's for sure about Iowa. New Hampshire is next. And next up, that feature article from Drake Bennett, "The Time I Sabotaged My Editor with Ransomware from the Dark Web." As you may be aware, there's money to be made on the internet. The question is, of course, is how. Not everyone has the reality distortion skills to start their own tech unicorn, or the Stanford connections to become an early employee there, or the indifference to sunlight necessary to become a world-class Fortnite gamer. Not everyone lives in the relatively few places where software engineering jobs are well-paying and plentiful. If you're willing to break the law, or at least the laws of the U.S., a country you may not yourself call home, your options expand. You can steal credit card numbers, or just buy them in bulk. You can hijack bank accounts and wire yourself money, or you can hijack email accounts and fool someone else into wiring you money. You can scam the lonely on dating sites. All of these ventures, though, require resources of one kind or another. A way to sell the stuff you buy with other people's plastic, a mule willing to cash out your purloined funds, or a talent for persuasion and patience for the long con, and usually some programming skill. But if you have none of these, there's always ransomware. Malicious software that encrypts data on a computer or a server, ransomware allows an attacker to extort a payment in exchange for the decryption key. Over the past year in the U.S., hackers hit the governments of Baltimore, New Orleans, and a raft of smaller municipalities, taking down city email servers and databases, police incident report systems, and in some cases even 911 dispatch centers. Hospitals, dependent on the flow of vital time-sensitive data, have proved particularly tempting targets. So have companies that specialize in remotely managing the IT infrastructure of smaller businesses and towns. Hacking them means effectively hacking all of their clients. As the number of attacks has grown, so has the scale of the victims and ransoms. Herb Stapleton, a section chief in the FBI's cyber division, says, Ransomware really started as something that targeted individuals. Then it started targeting smaller companies without strong internet security protections, and now it's evolved to larger companies and municipalities. In 2019, the Weather Channel, the French media group M6, and the shipping services firm Pitney Bowes were all hit. Last summer, two small Florida towns paid $1.1 million between them to unlock their data. According to the BBC, the European forensic firm Eurofin Scientific also paid off attackers, though it hasn't confirmed this. Travelex also won't say whether it paid its multi-million dollar ransom, though as I write this, the global currency exchanger's website remains down, a month after it was attacked. In a way, the rise of ransomware was foreordained. Simple, scalable, and low risk, it makes for a particularly tidy cybercrime. Some of the most successful variants are thought to have emerged from the states of the former Soviet Union, where tech-savvy young people can get a high-quality education, but not a commensurate quality job. That combination has helped birth an industry that, in big ways and small, is tech's outlaw twin. These days, prospective attackers don't have to create their own ransomware. They can buy it. If they don't really know how to use it, they can subscribe to services complete with customer support that will help coordinate attacks for them. Software as a service, SaaS in tech vernacular, is a mammoth global industry comprising everything from Salesforce.com customer relationship management software to the Slack workplace messaging platform to Dropbox cloud storage. Search for Ransomware as a Service, or RAS, on the dark web, that's R-A-A-S, in the dark web chat rooms that function as both forums and bazaars, and you'll get pages and pages of hits. In the public imagination, hackers are Mephistophelian savants. But they don't have to be. Not with ransomware. You could be Joe Schmo, just buying this stuff up, says Christopher Ellison, director of intelligence at the cybersecurity firm Flashpoint. And you could start a ransomware business out of it. You could even be a liberal arts educated writer with the primitive cargo cult understanding of how an iPhone or the internet work, and who regularly finds himself at the elbow of his office tech support whiz asking, again, how to find the share drive. In other words, you could be me, the author. But could you really? I didn't start out on this article planning to try my hand at ransomware. A few weeks in, though, it occurred to me that if someone like me could pull off a digital heist, it would function as a sort of hacking Turing test, proof that cybercrime had advanced to the point where software-aided ignorance would be indistinguishable from true skill. As a journalist, I've spent years writing about people who do things that I, if called upon, couldn't do myself. Here was my chance to be the man in the arena. Step 1. Spearfishing. In late 1989, medical researchers and computer hobbyists around the world opened their mailboxes, their actual physical ones, to find a 5 1/4-inch floppy disk containing an interactive program that evaluated someone's risk of contracting AIDS. At the time, an unchecked, fatal pandemic. In all, 20,000 disks from the PC Cyborg Corporation were mailed from London to addresses throughout Europe and Africa. But the disks had their own viral payload, an additional file that, once loaded onto a workstation, would hide files and encrypt their names, then fill the screen with a red box demanding a $189 software lease. A banker's draft, cashier's check, or international money order was to be mailed to a post office box in Panama. The AIDS Trojan, as it came to be known, was the world's first ransomware. Within weeks, an American named Joseph Popp was stopped on his way back to the U.S. from an AIDS conference in Kenya. An evolutionary biologist who specialized in baboons, Popp had caught the attention of security officers at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport because of his erratic behavior. According to a story later published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Popp, convinced he was being drugged by Interpol agents, had written, "Dr. Popp has been poisoned" on someone's duffel bag and then held it over his head. When his own luggage was searched, authorities discovered a PC Cyborg Corporation seal. Popp was extradited from his native Ohio to London, but eventually ruled unfit to stand trial. Among other things, he'd started wearing curlers in his beard to protect against radiation. He returned home, self-published a manifesto urging people to reproduce more, and was starting a butterfly sanctuary in Oneonta, New York, when he died in 2006. While Popp's motivations and mental fitness remain the subject of debate, the effectiveness of his ransomware does not. Most of the recipients of the disk didn't even load the pernicious file onto their computers. Among those who did, only a tiny number paid the ransom. For one thing, it was a pain, requiring a trip to both the bank and the post office, and it was unnecessary. One victim, a Belgian named Eddie Willems, was a computer systems analyst for a multinational insurer. He says, "I'm not a cryptologist, but I was able to easily see what it did. and I was able to put everything back in something like 10 to 15 minutes. Willems and other security researchers quickly circulated free AIDS Trojan decryption programs, also by floppy. It's a testament to Pop's imagination and possible mania that he attempted the scheme at all with the tools at his disposal. The idea of selling stolen data to the highest bidder wasn't new, but Pop's innovation, as Mikko Hyppönen, chief research officer at the Finnish cybersecurity firm F-Secure, puts it, was, quote, the realization that in many cases the highest bidder is the original owner of the information. A decade and a half later, technology caught up with Pop's insight, first in the form of the internet. In 2005, security researchers started seeing ransomware they dubbed GP code. In cybersecurity taxonomy, it's customary to bestow the same name on a strain of malware and the anonymous gang behind it. GP code smuggled itself onto computers as attachments to seemingly legitimate emails, a technique known as phishing. That's P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, phishing. If it's done at scale, or spear phishing, again with a PH, if a bespoke email is aimed at a single target. GP code's later versions also used much stronger encryption to scramble the contents of files. The only real weakness was the payment step. Ransoms were settled up by prepaid credit or gift cards, and therefore flowed through the highly regulated pipes of the global financial system. Over time, with the help and prodding of law enforcement, payment processors grew better at spotting ransom payments and recovering at least some of the money. That problem was solved, from the ransomer's point of view, by Bitcoin. By 2013, the cryptocurrency had become mainstream enough that a ransomware gang decided to give it a try, in a variant that would come to be known as CryptoLocker. Bitcoin isn't technically untraceable, especially when people convert it into dollars or euros or another fiat currency. Still, the forensics are difficult and time-consuming, complicated by tumblers and other anonymizing measures that obscure a transaction's path through the public blockchain. And there's no payment processor or law enforcement to ask to shut it down, all of which makes it ideal for ransomware. The only wrinkle is that most people are still unfamiliar with the mechanics of buying and selling cryptocurrency. It's not uncommon for ransomware attackers to encourage their victims to reach out if they want help with the process. CryptoLocker was hugely successful. Three Italian computer science researchers traced 771 payments flowing into Bitcoin wallets connected to the ransomware variant, totaling 1,226 Bitcoin. That's $1.1 million at the time. Likely a very conservative figure. And the CryptoLocker recipe, phishing, strong encryption, Bitcoin, remains the dominant template for ransomware today. But there are others. Some attacks pretend to be from a law enforcement agency that's locked down your machine because of illicit material found there. Some ensure the material is there first by downloading actual child pornography. Some attackers start by luring victims to a compromised website where a software exploit kit can slip the malware through their browser's vulnerabilities. And some attacks turn out to not be ransomware at all. NotPetya, which caused billions of dollars in damages worldwide in 2017, lacked any means to reverse its encryption. It's widely suspected to have been a Russian cyber weapon built neither to steal information nor hold it for ransom, but simply to destroy it. The FBI's Stapleton says, with some of the more sophisticated cyber criminal organizations that we've found, ransomware is just another tool to use for the monetization of their cyber activities. Ryan Olson, a vice president at cybersecurity firm Palo Alto Networks, remembers monitoring a computer for a client after hackers found a way in. First, they looked for credit card numbers. Then, they searched for passwords or login credentials they could use to take over the network. And then the last thing they did, he says, just on the way out the door, was to install some ransomware and encrypt all the files. Step 2. Infection. When I started shopping around for my ransomware service in October, the community was still grieving Grand Crab. Rolled out at the beginning of 2018, GandCrab wasn't the first ransomware as a service. But its overwhelming success, the cybersecurity firm Bitdefender estimates that at one point it comprised half of the world's attempted ransomware attacks, had demonstrated the model's commercial potential. The GandCrab gang had licensed their software to affiliates, fellow hackers with access to compromised computers or lists of email addresses to phish, in exchange for a percentage of the total take. And they had diligently stayed ahead of the efforts of antivirus programmers, shipping out 5 major software updates, according to computer security researcher Brian Krebs. Then, on May 31st of 2019, a post on the Russian language forum exploit.in announced GandCrab's well-deserved retirement. Over 15 months, the writer claimed, its affiliates had pulled in $2 billion, $150 million of which had flowed back to the creators. Potential affiliates were left asking each other in thread after thread what the next Gancrab might be. I'm not going to name the forum where I ended up finding my ransomware as a service. I don't imagine many readers of this article are aspiring ransomware entrepreneurs, but I don't want to make things easier for anyone who is. Like most similar sites, it's on the dark web, a region of the internet that's been configured to be inaccessible by normal web browsers. The forum's logo is a DOS green skull. That's DOS, if you remember the old operating systems. The posts are in English, though that's evidently not the first language of many of the authors, and the mores would be familiar to anyone who's spent time in an overwhelmingly young, male setting. Start a post with possibly a stupid question, but, and someone will respond, "That is a really stupid question." Yet, I was also struck by the willingness of participants to answer questions in detail, or just offer encouragement to an anonymous stranger on a range of criminal mischief topics. One October post begins, "Below is an amazing list of resources. It has the best books to check out, some websites that have practice hacking targets, a list of free virtual networks to practice on, etc." I wasn't the only clueless person on the site. "Easy to use ransomware wanted" was the headline of an August 31st post. Another read, "I'm browsing resources to acquire ransomware and the like. What specifically do I need to learn to use this stuff?" Some forum members see newbies, and script kiddies like these as targets for scorn. Others see them as opportunities. In the hacker ecosystem, the script kiddie's natural predator is the ripper, a person who sells bogus goods or just takes the noob's Bitcoin payment and disappears. A lot of the back and forth on the forum focuses on whether whoever is peddling this or that software or service can be trusted. I, of course, was a noob's noob, protected only by an awareness of how little I knew and the narrow scope of my ambitions. The plan, worked out with my editor, Max Chafkin, was that I would ransom a single target. Him. Max, reasonably enough, wasn't eager to put his own actual personal information at risk, or that of our employer, which handles sensitive data for the world's wealthiest financial institutions. So, the two of us bought cheap laptops and took care not to connect them at any point to our work internet. Max loaded his with a grab bag of files, some WikiLeaks documents, a PDF of the Mueller report, some random pictures of cats, boats, and monkeys, and what he described to me as, quote, "a bunch of Romanian academic papers," unquote. He then steeled himself for my attack, which I planned to announce to him in advance. What the plan lacked in realism, it made up for in safety and hopefully our not getting fired or arrested. Several states explicitly outlaw ransomware attacks, and legislators in Maryland recently introduced a bill that would criminalize the mere possession of ransomware. There are also broader federal computer fraud statutes, which were used in the 2018 indictment of two Iranian hackers allegedly behind attacks against Atlanta, Newark, and several large hospital systems. Ransomware prosecutions remain rare, but I, unlike most attackers, was actually in the U.S. Still, the laws on the books so far seem to require the intent to attack an unaware, unconspiring victim. "A person shall not knowingly possess ransomware with the intent to use or employ that ransomware," says the Michigan law, without authorization of the other person. My victim would be fully informed, indeed complicit. We were just two consenting adults taking risks on the internet. If Max tried to pretend otherwise, I had emails. The Bloomberg lawyer we talked to basically agreed. He did, however, suggest that, if I got the impression I was about to do business with the North Korean government or some other sanctioned entity, I should get back in touch with him. Step 3. Ransom payment. None of this would have been possible without Joe Stewart. Stewart lives in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and runs his own blockchain development and security research company. Since last year, he's been working with a cybersecurity company, Armor, who put me in touch with him. He was one of the first analysts to describe the criminal uses for the hijacked computer networks known as botnets. He also coded an early reverse-engineered decryptor to allow victims of carelessly written ransomware to unscramble their files for free. Several years ago, he helped a couple of my colleagues identify a hacker working for the Chinese People's Liberation Army. Stewart is quiet and in conversation wears a stony expression that I eventually learned to read as attentiveness rather than dismay. I'd been talking to him over the phone for a few months before I told him I wanted to try ransomware myself. He told me that once I got my hands on some, I could come down to Myrtle Beach and deploy it from his computer lab. The ransomware service I ended up using was the first one I found, a few minutes after logging into the hacker chat room I tried. Even at the time, there were warning signs. The consensus on the forum was decidedly skeptical. One poster complained, "This guy has been spamming this shit for days now and acts like no one has ever done this before. Can't explain a simple sales pitch about it." The coder himself had weighed in, telling that critic to STFU, which stands for shut the fuck up, before mocking him with an obscure reference to the coding language C#, and signing off with another STFU. Still, the inquiries I'd sent to other sellers had gone unanswered, and a couple others were clearly fake. And while the popular Ranyan ransomware as a service costs $900 a year, according to the possibly defunct ad I had tried responding to, this one was only $150. I decided it was worth a try. The morning of October 23rd, I paid my .02013566 Bitcoin and sent a note through Proton Mail, an encrypted email service, to the address on the payment page. A half hour later, I got a response. "Hello, sir, your account is activated now. Sorry for the delay." The webpage I could now access was white, with a black Mercator projection of the world beneath a row of tabs. Clicking on Dashboard called up an empty table with the heading Victims. Its columns would presumably populate once I had multiple campaigns going, with the names of each and their corresponding decryption keys. A second tab, Builder, took me to a page that created my malware for me. I typed in a Proton Mail address for my victims to use and specified the kind of operating system on my target computer. The vast majority of malware is written for Microsoft Windows. On Stuart's suggestion, I was using the Linux operating system, decreasing the chances of getting hacked myself. I clicked on a button labeled Build, and a box popped up asking me if I wanted to download a file. After a few moments' hesitation, I clicked Yes. I now had a piece of malware on my computer. I attached it to an email and sent it, clearly marked, to Stuart. By the time I showed up in Myrtle Beach on the morning of November 11th, Stuart had run it on a special quarantine computer he used to defuse and dissect malware. High-quality variants are often coded so they won't deploy if they sense they're in a sandbox, such as Stuart's, or they have dormancy periods longer than the attention span of the average security researcher. My malware wasn't so equipped, one of the several traits that suggested I hadn't procured top-shelf product. The ransomware service itself had been built not on some cryptocurrency-accepting, law-enforcement-unfriendly overseas web hoster, which would, as Stuart put it, have been best practices in the criminal underground, but on Amazon Web Services Cloud. A subpoena could produce the name attached to the Amazon account, potentially leading law enforcement directly to my provider. The biggest snag, though, was the decryptor I got from the site. After receiving my ransom payment, I was supposed to send the file to my victim along with an alphabetical key. But when Stuart and I tested it out, it didn't work. The files in Stuart's sandbox stayed encrypted. In the short term, that wouldn't be my problem. I'd already be paid by the time Max discovered this flaw. But just as with traditional kidnapping, the information ransoming business model only works if victims are at least moderately hopeful they'll get their data upon payment. As a result, ransomers often go out of their way to show their good faith and dependability. It's common practice to decrypt a few files for free as proof of concept. Some ransomware-as-a-service dashboards dispense with the term victim entirely. Screenshots of the Ranyan variant, taken by Armor analysts, show a table headed clients instead. Ellison at Flashpoint forwarded me a note one ransomware gang sent their victims that laid out security measures they could take to avoid future attacks. For Stuart, it had been easy enough to throw together a decryption workaround. "I'm guessing he's never actually tested the code in a real environment," he wrote to me in an email. Rather than send Max a key to type or paste in himself, I'd need to send him a few lines of code and instructions for where to put them. It was inelegant, but it was the sort of thing that I figured I could walk him through. But as Mike Tyson famously said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. On the appointed morning, sitting in Stuart's windowless computer lab, I logged into my specially purchased laptop, opened up the anonymizing Tor browser, and clicked on the bookmarked link for the dark web address of my ransomware-as-a-service control panel. But instead of the Mercator projection and the row of helpful tabs, I saw only one cryptic note. It read, "We are taking down the website in order to Lake of the Users." My first thought was to wonder if Lake of the Users was a coding term I was unaware of, something related to torrents or streams. My second, more practical thought was that I had better email tech support. I wrote to an encrypted email address containing the name of the comic book anti-hero Johnny Blaze, "Hi, I see you took the website down. How do I keep access?" The answer came back an hour later. "You have to buy a pro version if you want to keep using this." The pro version, I learned, would cost an additional $500 on top of my $150 when I'd signed up 2.5 weeks earlier. The pro version had cost $300, though my provider was at pains to point out that it now featured Android-compatible malware. What became clear in a back-and-forth that went on for much of the morning was that my ransomware as a service had ceased to be a service at all. The server, along with the website, had been taken down, though this, too, was presented as an opportunity. I could host it myself. At Stuart's prompting, I asked how I'd be able to get my decryption keys now that the site was taken down. Johnny Blaze informed me, apologetically, that they'd forgotten to back up their database. Had the whole thing been a scam? Was I dealing with a ripper? If so, why had they gone to the trouble to stand up an actual service and create actual, if cruddy, malware? In retrospect, it seems more likely that my not particularly adept suppliers, their product having flopped, had decided to close up shop for lack of enough paying users. It's conceivable I was their only one, and they were seeing if I might want to buy them out. The problem wasn't just the decryption keys. Without a server, ransomware like mine was all but inert. As Stuart patiently explained, before encrypting any files, the program first generated the decryption key and sent it back to the ransomware as a service server to pop up in my dashboard. If the server didn't answer, the program wouldn't proceed. Deflated, I wrote Johnny Blaze asking if I was entitled to a refund. I was told, curtly, that I was not. Stuart said, "I think there's a way around this." A quick reminder to all of you, we're now a little over halfway through our program. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Mike Malangoni, and this is the Monday, February 10th edition of Business World. Okay, now back to that article. Stuart said, "I think there's a way around this." Sitting at one end of the room on a black leather couch, he hunched forward over his laptop. Minutes later, he sent me a line of code and instructions to forward to Max, at that moment sitting in New York in front of his burner Dell, sending me prodding text messages. Stuart's fix replaced some code in Max's computer operating system so that when the malware told it to reach out to the now-defunct Amazon web server, it would reach out to one of Stuart's servers instead, which would acknowledge receipt of the key and give the green light to encrypt. My ransomware service provider, in other words, was now Stuart. And so, the groundwork laid, I launched my reverse-engineered puppet ransomware. An instant later, Max received an email from a trusted colleague. "Hey, Max, sorry it's so late and that it's such a giant file, but here's the draft attached. Let me know what you think." He clicked on the draft, only for his antivirus software to flag it and warn him not to open it. Well-designed computer viruses, like actual viruses, envelop their payloads in obfuscatory layers of code. Mine announced itself like a man going through customs with cocaine trickling out of his pants leg. Gamely, Max opened the file. At first, nothing happened. A few minutes passed, and we started texting back and forth about trying again. Max recounts, "Then, I looked away from my screen for a second, and suddenly there was this crazy message." While ransomware designers often opt for a blandly informational aesthetic, ours had aimed for something more demented. Max's screen filled with the image of a cloud of smoke, a pale, grasping hand reaching out from its center, and the scrawled words, "Your files are encrypted." Max's WikiLeaks downloads, his cat photos, his Romanian monographs, all of them were gibberish. The Mueller report mysteriously was unaffected. Max wrote me a note full of theatrical betrayal and outrage, to which I responded in a tone of bloodless professionalism, telling him that the ransom, $100, and my Bitcoin wallet address. If I thought he was dragging his feet, I could have given him a deadline, after which the ransom would increase or I would destroy the decryption key. Once I got an alert from my cryptocurrency app that his payment was processing, I sent him the decryptor with Stuart's jury-rigged key. Max ran it as instructed and watched as his files returned, one by one, to normal. He got his data back. I got my money. As agreed, I did eventually return it. But the grasping hand image didn't ever go away. In the end, it's hard to claim that my ransomware and I had really passed our test. The cybercrime singularity appears a ways off. When I returned from Myrtle Beach, I contacted a particularly knowledgeable and helpful-seeming poster on one of the dark web forums. After insisting on some ground rules and taking various steps to verify who I was, he or she agreed to talk. "In regards to types of malware, I have coded and used almost anything you can think of. Backdoors, rats, cryptors, droppers, data destroyers, CSRF and phishing pages, ransomware, etc.," he wrote. He was dismissive of much of what you could buy. In his description, the recent surge in ransomware attacks sounded almost like a bubble. He wrote, "Many of those ransomware projects are just complete junk." amateur coders finding something on the software development platform GitHub, making a couple of cosmetic changes, and then trying to pass it off as their own. In the end, ransomware as a service does allow for higher numbers of less experienced people to have access to ransomware, but the most successful attacks I know of are still carried out by fewer people using more private code. Of course, an inexperienced horde launching incompetent ransomware attacks can still cause plenty of damage, and every master was once a script kiddie. When I emailed my ransomware as a service suppliers asking to interview them for this story, they were more than happy to talk, though they were, in the end, typically gnomic. "We are team. We are 18 to 26-year-old teens," Johnny Blaze wrote back. One thing they did emphasize was that ransomware as a service that I had tried was old news. The team was already coming to market with newer product, something they promised would be, quote, much better. And that, from Drake Bennett, was the time I sabotaged my editor with ransomware from the dark web. An interesting article, to be sure. Okay, next up, our final feature article, a sexist joke cost Ken Fisher $4 billion in assets. He still runs $121 billion. This is by Sabrina Wilmer. Ken Fisher ranks among the most successful money managers in America, but you can reach one of his main offices only by driving up a steep and curving country road in Northern California. A compound of simple wood-shingled buildings, it sits atop a peak with sweeping views of Redwoods and Half Moon Bay. "King's Mountain Country Store," reads a weathered sign near the entrance, lined with moss-covered boulders. An avowed cheapskate who buys shoes at Walmart, Fisher picked up this property years ago at a fire sale price. It had been a commercial chinchilla farm in the 1940s. Fisher, 69, grew up here in San Mateo County and remembers the freedom he had as a child, hitchhiking in the area or taking the train to nearby San Francisco as a 10-year-old. He says, "It was just a marvelous world that used to exist, just so free and so different." Speaking of the business he built, he says, "I had this vision, which was sort of like a pre-industrial age family, like a farm." His wife and children have all worked for the company, Fisher Investments, and the Fishers once lived at this Woodside, California compound, where a statue of a bull fighting a bear adorns a back patio. Some of his former employees, referring to the way many are molded in the founder's image or Fisherized, have called his firm the Cult on the Hill. Late last year, the outside world came crashing into this idyll, after comments Fisher made at a San Francisco conference sparked anger on Twitter, and then were reported by Bloomberg News and others. Fisher cautioned against using financial planning, which involves getting people to talk about their money, as a way to sign up new investing clients, comparing that approach to picking up a woman in a bar. But he was crude about it, making a reference to trying to get into a girl's pants, one horrified attendee told Bloomberg. A recorded excerpt of his remarks, broadcast later by CNBC, captures Fisher saying you wouldn't go up to a woman and ask what's in your pants. In an interview with Bloomberg at the time, Fisher said his comments had been taken out of context. Large clients, including Fidelity Investments and Goldman Sachs Group, as well as some public pension funds, pulled nearly $4 billion from his company in a month. Then and now, he says he made similar comments many times, and no one had complained. Still, he apologized, though he also repeatedly said his remarks were misinterpreted. "By saying those inappropriate things, I was demonstrating inappropriateness," he says in a two-hour interview, his first extended remarks since the crisis. "I said, it would blow up in your face. You'd come off like a jerk." In his view, some big investors bolted only because of pressure from the press. "Literally, we have people that told us they wouldn't fire us if it wasn't for you people writing about this," he says, his general counsel and an outside lawyer by his side. Fisher speaks in a gravelly, stentorian voice, like an anchorman's. In fact, you might have seen him commenting on financial news shows in his boxy suit and a wide gold bull and bear power tie. Or maybe you've seen him on one of his ubiquitous ads, or learned about him from the bulk mail pitches he sends out on heavy embossed paper. Perhaps you've read one of his many books or his column that ran for years in Forbes. With help from the soaring bull market, his assets under management have more than quadrupled since 2009 to more than $121 billion at the end of December. He's also gotten rich, with an estimated net worth of about $4 billion. Fisher seems like a figure from an older Wall Street, before the low-cost index funds began to replace investment gurus such as him. He's still able to charge lucrative fees for actively managing money. He also brings to mind the age before the rise of the corporate HR department and the hashtag MeToo movement. Some former employees describe Fisher Investments' corporate culture as a boys' club, where the use of crude language had long made some women and men uncomfortable. For some institutional investors hearing about Fisher's comments in October, walking away from the firm was a fairly simple decision. Many of them, especially retirement funds that represent diverse memberships, want to show that they support equality for women. But another part of Fisher's business is serving about 70,000 individual investors. That kind of money turns out to be a lot stickier. It doesn't leave easily. In part, that may be due to inertia, but it's also because of the relationship an investment advisor can build with clients. And Fisher has a kind of genius for communicating to small investors that he's on their side. Catherine Cardona, a retired teacher and client in rural Oregon, who heard Fisher speak at a luncheon, says he's awesome. He can talk about money and not make it boring. He cracks jokes. Fisher Investments says it's brought in hundreds more clients by representing billions in new money since early October. Fisher isn't going anywhere, at least as long as this bull market lasts. Fisher's father, Philip, was legendary on Wall Street. He was an early practitioner of what's now known as growth investing and wrote a best-selling 1958 guide to stock picking that influenced Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett. But whereas Philip offered his investment services to no more than a dozen clients, Ken has a passion for mass marketing. Small investors make up more than two-thirds of Fisher Investments' business, which Ken founded in 1979 out of his basement. Ken himself says, "I send junk mail," says Mayor Statman, a finance professor at Santa Clara University who has collaborated with Fisher on investment research. "There are many professionals who are bashful about marketing. We tend to underestimate the effect of marketing in financial services, as if it were all about alpha," he says, alpha being investor jargon for beating the market. In 1995, Fisher sent 5,000 letters to high-income prospects, doctors specifically, at a cost of about a dollar apiece. The positive response he got made an impression, and direct mail has captivated Fisher ever since. So much so that he's used it as a kind of incantation. In the early 2000s, he was known to say something that sounded like, "God, I'm someone. God, I'm someone. God, I'm someone." But it's really, "God, I'm someone. Got him someone, got him someone." This is an acronym, GDDMSAHNWAM. It's an acronym and distillation of his dream. Globally Dominant Direct Marketer Separate Account High Net Worth Asset Management. In his promotions, Fisher has long stressed his status as a best-selling author, like his father. The younger Fisher had help from his company, which bought copies of his books. Some employees could expense books, which would pile up in warehouses and staffers' garages, according to people familiar with the arrangement. The company says that it sent books to customers for educational purposes and that they were a perfectly legitimate business expense. Despite being so much in the public eye, Fisher describes himself as an introvert. He can be nerdy, rattling off economic and financial jargon such as mean variance optimization. He can also be condescending when challenged. He responds to a question in an interview about his investment approach. "That's one of the most basic questions that anyone could possibly ever ask, so let me take you through the basic thinking to see it correctly." Still, he doesn't come off as a polished finance guy. He drives a 15-year-old Volvo and likes to duct tape together old shoes. He went to Humboldt State University in rural Arcata, California, where for a time he wanted to study forestry. He switched to economics and after graduation went to work for his dad. While setting up his own business, he used to play slide guitar in dive bars. As it grew, he positioned himself as a market expert and an advocate for the everyday affluent. Among his books are How to Smell a Rat, The 5 Signs of Financial Fraud, and Debunkery, Learn It, Do It, and Profit from It, Seeing Through Wall Street's Money-Killing Myths. He's very good at showing the many ways brokers, as the joke goes, can make their customers broker. Fisher is best known for his ads that blare, "I hate annuities, and you should too." He's even more emphatic in a promotional video saying, quote, "I would die and go to hell before I would sell an annuity," unquote. He's picked a fat, largely deserving target. Annuities, which are a kind of investment product issued by insurance companies, are notorious for their punishing fees and confusing rules. And they're aimed at many of the same people Fisher is selling to, people who may have a half million or more squirreled away in a 401k or an IRA rollover. Fisher's ads invite readers to call or click to get a free report. That gets you on the sales lead list. Some 125 people had filed complaints against Fisher Investments with the Federal Trade Commission since 2016, alleging excessive calls, emails, and mailings, according to records released under the Freedom of Information Act. "Calls repeat every day. I submit a complaint every day. No corrective action taken. What can I do?" that's a quote from a resident from Waterford, Pennsylvania, wrote in a 2016 email to the FTC. The company disputes the FTC complaints and says its sales force acts respectfully and professionally. Fisher says that the important thing about his approach is that sales and financial advice are kept distinct. Traditional commission-based brokers are expected to sell hard, to engage in what Fisher calls hornswoggling, at the same time that they're providing service to customers. He says, "I didn't like that, so I wanted to separate the sales from post-sales service." Once individual customers sign on with Fisher, his company generally charges 1 to 1.5% of assets per year to run their portfolios. Although that far exceeds the cost of investing in most mutual funds, Fisher says the price includes broader financial advice, as well as extras, such as hundreds of private luncheons for clients around the country. "We do things for clients no one else does." He calls it a total offering. Bloomberg Businessweek spoke with more than 24 current and former employees of Fisher Investments. Some describe an always-be-calling operation reminiscent of a David Mamet play. In addition to the Woodside location, Fisher has main offices in the city of San Mateo and Plano, Texas. Several years ago, he moved the company's headquarters to Woodsy Camas, Washington, outside of Portland. Michael Kay, who worked as an account executive from 2017 until June, says he would make at least 250 outbound sales calls a day. He says in an interview, "Fisher recruits people out of college. We are poor, smart, and hungry for money, so we can be molded into an efficient closing sales machine." Kay testified in a 2018 lawsuit in California, claiming that Fisher stiffed employees out of overtime, allegations the company denies. A lawyer for the company says Fisher never required so many calls in a day. When the company loses a client, managers will interrogate investment counselors and rummage through their notes, according to some former employees. Fisher prizes loyalty. He likes to praise those who, quote, "bleed Fisher green," unquote, and have the initials of Fisher Investments stamped on their butt, according to an internal company memo. The company, however, bristles at the cult comparison, saying it prizes independent thought. Male entry-level account executives sometimes displayed a frat house attitude. "What do you think is hung like a horse?" one person wrote in a 2013 email. Another named a female coworker and, in an apparent reference to her genitalia, wrote, "That's her labies, though, bro." Fisher provided these emails when Bloomberg asked about the behavior of one of the employees who's still with the company. After the email episode was demoted, he was demoted, was docked 3 days' pay, and had his compensation cut to $14 an hour from $24 an hour. Fisher says such episodes inevitably occur in a company with 3,800 employees. "When we find out about things, we deal with them pretty completely," he says. Still, some employees complain of repeated comments about women's clothing and appearance. Joey Hayes, who worked in the marketing department from 2013 to 2015 and sat near the sales bullpen, says, "I got to hear and witness a lot of things that didn't sit well with me. No sooner would a woman leave the area than these men would start initiating highly sexualized conversations about these women." Hayes, who is gay, says he also heard employees make homophobic remarks and vulgar sexual comments about clients. The company says a female employee once complained to its human resources department about Hayes, saying he made an inappropriate comment. Hayes says he and others joked about the coworker, and he later apologized. Fisher's own words were part of the macho atmosphere. "I have a hard-on looking at all of you," some people remember him saying at a London gathering. Back in 2008, as financial markets were reeling, a woman at a staff meeting asked Fisher if he'd considered shifting into defensive holdings. "Why would I want half a dick?" he replied. Fisher doesn't dispute that he made comments such as these, though he says he may have been misunderstood. In a recording from a 2018 investing conference, Fisher can be heard saying, "If I was 30 years old and I had to do it all over again, I would have more sex. Once you get older, you're like a Christmas tree. You're firm once a year and the balls are just for decoration." Some in the audience laughed. A number of women at Fisher Investments say they've been fairly treated in what they consider a meritocracy. The company notes that 3 of 5 senior executive vice presidents reporting to CEO Damian Ornani are women. One of those leaders, Jill Hitchcock, who oversees the company's largest business unit and was the former head of human resources, says Fisher's comments have never offended her because she always considered him to be using analogies to explain complex topics. Hitchcock says, "If I didn't believe in what we were doing in the firm and the culture, I wouldn't have stayed here." She's a widowed mother of 2 boys who's worked at the company for 20 years. "I've also seen how our employees and how our clients react to seeing Ken, which is why they love to see Ken speak." The company points to an internal survey showing 79% of employees think it's a great place to work. Jacob Gamble, who worked there from 2002 through 2015, says the company does well by its clients. He says, "It can be hard, and you're held accountable to learn from every single little flaw that comes across in your work, but that's how they're successful and how they move forward." If Fisher's sales force is aggressive, so is his investment approach. When prospects turn over their nest egg to Fisher, his company often puts the bulk of it in stocks, even for older clients. That's an outlier for an industry that typically recommends a more conservative approach. All things being equal, younger people should go heavier on stocks, retirees should go in a more fixed income direction, and so forth. In retirement funds designed for 65-year-olds, Vanguard and Fidelity place just over half of investments in stocks. Charles Schwab and BlackRock, 40%. Fisher has little time for the idea that it's safer to keep a lot of money in bonds, not when you need to grow enough savings to fund retirement. On a podcast, Fisher once referred to husbands who put their spouse's money in a mix of stocks and bonds as no better than wife beaters. Fisher says, for example, a 65-year-old man may marry a woman 10 years younger who can expect to live many more decades. That means the couple has to plan for a longer future. He says, if you have a 30-year time horizon, you ought to be starting off with a 100% equity benchmark. Besides stocks, another investment he likes is an obscure instrument called an exchange-traded note, or ETN. They're essentially contracts issued by a bank that entitle the owner to a certain payout. The note's returns can be linked to the performance of other securities, such as an index of stocks, and they can be designed so they return even more when those stocks rise and fall even harder when the stocks fall. The risk and costs of ETNs have drawn scrutiny from federal regulators, and most investors shun them. Although ETNs are backed by major banks, one risk is the possibility that an issuer might not be able to pay. Fisher Investments is one of the biggest ETN players in the world, with $6 billion of clients' money invested in them last year, making up a quarter of the market. The company says its ETNs are less volatile than most individual stocks and work in its portfolios to reduce risk relative to return. The main investment strategy he uses for wealthy clients' accounts has trailed the benchmark the firm uses over the past decade by about 1 percentage point annualized. Over the past 3 and 5 years, however, it has beaten the same index by a percentage point annually, according to the company. The portfolios he runs for institutions tend to have lower fees, and some have performed better. For Florida's pension fund, the firm returned, on average, 2 percentage points per year above its benchmark over the past 10 years. No doubt, leaning into a bull market has been good for Fisher. After all, this one's been going on for more than a decade. Cardona, the Fisher client, says she has confidence in her 100% stock portfolio and also likes the customer service she gets. As for the remarks that got Fisher in trouble, she says people are too politically correct these days. "What he says doesn't bother me, as it doesn't impact the 401k," says Cardona, who is 74. In a bear market, the company's aggressive stance can backfire. Fisher faced at least a dozen legal claims from customers who lost money in the 2008 financial crisis. Clients alleged that the company advertised a tailored approach while putting everyone in the same stocks, misled them about risks, or failed to build suitable portfolios. Most were resolved in arbitration, where the outcome wasn't always public. One arbitrator ordered Fisher to pay out $376,000 in damages to a retiree in New Orleans who signed up in September 2007 and lost 57% of her $876,000 nest egg in little more than a year. But in some other cases, arbitrators sided with Fisher, saying that clients had sought out growth portfolios of stocks, understood the risks they were taking, and would have prospered if they had ridden out the downturn as the company advised. Several former employees say Fisher would identify clients who know prominent people, such as lawyers, politicians, and journalists, flagging them in case they became unhappy with their investments. A 2015 corporate script tells investment counselors to determine whether customers have such high-profile people in their sphere of influence. Fisher denies the effort was designed to protect the company. Instead, he says, the script was part of a since-abandoned effort to create a panel of experts the company could harness for research. This was effectively an innovative attempt that failed, he says. In response to the negative publicity about Fisher, the company introduced a counteroffensive. On October 29th, Hitchcock, the 20-year veteran and senior executive, asked hundreds of women employees to gather for a last-minute meeting at Camas and three other main offices. She asked them to sign releases, permitting them to appear in photos for an ad campaign. More than 1,000 employees, or more than a quarter of Fisher's workforce, are women, and 350 appeared in the ad, the company says. Full-page spreads would ultimately run in the Wall Street Journal, the Dallas Morning News, and newspapers around the country under the headline, "You heard their story, now hear ours." Along with the group photo, it featured seven senior women offering testimonials about the company's integrity, ethics, and empowerment of women. Privately, some of the women in the ad say they felt pressure to participate. In interviews, others say they were delighted to vouch for the company. People are treated equally here, regardless of race, gender, and culture, says Jessica Smith, a Fisher Investments vice president. This is a place that really strives to do what's best for our clients, and that's much different from an industry that's just trying to make money. The woman-focused campaign referred readers to a website that asked for phone numbers, addresses, and emails, making it a source of fresh sales leads. Back in his Woodside Mountain readout, Fisher says he's proud of the culture he's built, both for men and women. The company has launched a diversity and inclusion task force. Business Week Best Places to Launch a Career, reads an award in the office. As he did when evoking the days of the family farm, he can sound like a kind of patriarch as he mourns what he calls a world that doesn't exist anymore, but existed when I was young. Fisher wants young people to join his company out of college and stay until they retire, as they did in the age of the IBM lifer. He revels in noting managers who have been with him for decades. Ever since the backlash against his comments began, Fisher has expressed bewilderment that outsiders would react so strongly. I realized that there's no place for that in the work world in any way at all and committed myself to never saying words like that again or anything like that again ever, he says. During the interview, he speaks slowly, as if measuring his words, and pauses frequently. Fisher says his own employees, with whom he's long worked side by side, never said anything to him when he made an off-color analogy, not once, not ever. He says, those people know that I'm not perfect, but they also don't get offended by anything that I do because they know how hard I try for them. And have tried for them for a really long time. And that, with Janet Lauren from Sabrina Wilmer, was a sexist joke cost Ken Fisher $4 billion in assets. He still runs $121 billion. Some big investors were quick to drop their money manager, but his sales machine is doing just fine. An interesting article. Okay, folks, that does it for this week's edition of Business World. Reminder, I'm your volunteer reader, Mike Malangoni. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Don't forget to find this and other programs on demand, some of them that aren't even on the air. They are exclusive to on demand. Just go to our website, sunsounds.org. That's sunsounds.org. Then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for more wonderful programming from Sun Sounds of Arizona. Again, I'm your volunteer reader, Mike Malangoni. Have a great week, everybody.